The U.S. Supreme Court began its new term today, gathering in person for the first time since the pandemic began, except for Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who is vaccinated but tested positive for COVID-19 last week and is joining from home. The docket includes cases on some of the most politically charged issues: abortion, gun rights, the death penalty, and the separation of church and state. This term also begins as public confidence in the court is at its lowest in decades. For a look at what's to come, let's bring in Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts a podcast, Amicus. Dahlia, welcome back.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the big abortion case before the Supreme Court, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Tell us about this case.
This is a big deal. This is a Mississippi law that prohibits abortions after 15 weeks. And the court, after delaying hearing it, agreed to hear it after Ruth Bader Ginsburg was replaced by Amy Coney Barrett. And interestingly, Mississippi, in its briefing in this case, asks the court to kind of shoot for the moon and overturn Roe v. Wade altogether. And while that's been docketed, and that will be heard in December, we had a whole sidebar issue in September about the Texas 6 weeks abortion ban, which really, I think, rocket fueled the concern that the court may be absolutely willing to go for it on Roe v. Wade.
So talk about the Mississippi law first. Some think that the 6-3 majority conservative court may actually overturn Roe v. Wade. Do you think that's likely with this case?
The question is whether they will write the sentence Roe v. Wade is overturned, or just fiddle with the doctrine from Roe and the Casey case from 1992, essentially saying that whatever that undue burden standard is really ephemeral and only exists on paper. It would end up closing the only abortion clinic remaining in Mississippi. And so I think one of the things we have to focus on is whether they write that sentence, Roe v. Wade is overturned, or simply make it impossible for Mississippi and states like Mississippi to go on protecting abortion rights. I think that's the real question. Mm.
So tell us how the Mississippi case and the Texas abortion case intersect, because last month the justices decided just before midnight to allow the Texas abortion restrictions to go into effect. This was outside the court's normal procedures, right? What's known as the shadow docket. Explain the ramifications of that decision and how it might impact the Mississippi case.
Well, first of all, be very careful, because last week Justice Alito gave a speech at Notre Dame saying we're not allowed to call it the shadow docket because it sounds evil and nefarious. So I think we're meant to call it the emergency docket, but you are quite right. The court has been very, very active on this docket that allows for late night emergency orders. The court spent the summer striking down, for instance, the eviction moratorium, reinstating the Remain in Mexico policy, and then, as you say, the capstone on September 1st, allowing Texas's 6-week ban to go into effect. All of this done in late night orders, cases barely briefed and not argued. The cases formally are quite different. Texas's ban is not, they say, a ban. It's simply evades all judicial review. It was constructed so that no state actor can enforce this 6-week ban. And in fact, everyone else is conscripted to bring civil suits against any provider who performs an abortion after 6 weeks. And that was designed so that no court could hear it and enjoin it. And you're quite right. On September 1, the court said, well, we can't hear it or enjoin it. As a consequence, nobody in Texas has been able to procure an abortion after 6 weeks, even though the viability line is at 24 weeks. Obviously, the Mississippi case is quite different. Here we do have state actors. It has made its way up the normal channels. But I think that the two cases intersect insofar as the court's willingness to let Texas go ahead and put this quote-unquote bounty statute into effect signals to a lot of people who are watching the court that the court might be willing to big swing and to really, really allow abortion to become virtually impossible, again, without ever writing the words Roe v. Wade is overturned.
Dahlia, talk about this emergency docket, the so-called shadow docket that Justice Alito doesn't want us to call it that, but that's typically what it's been called. Is the court using this method more often? And what are the implications of that?
There's always been an emergency docket, so that's not new. What is new is exactly what you've identified, the massive uptick in emergency docket orders. And as I said earlier, part of the problem with this docket is not just that you tend to get midnight orders that are a paragraph and a half. They're not signed. We don't know which justice wrote them. Sometimes we don't know which justice is even voted. And perhaps more troublingly, not just the increase in frequency, but the increase in use on these huge consequential national issues. And I think the last thing is that we're seeing the court use these emergency orders to cite prior emergency orders, for instance, in some of the COVID restriction cases, and saying to the courts, hey, we already decided this on the emergency docket in three sentences. Now that's the law. Mm. So I think it's both frequency and also changing actual doctrine in the shadows.
There's also a gun rights case coming before the U.S. Supreme Court this term, Dahlia. It's been more than a decade since the court has heard a challenge to gun laws, and this case was brought by gun owners in New York State. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is the other one that I think has the possibility of really profoundly changing the landscape. In 2008, in District of Columbia versus Heller, the court had announced for the first time that one had a Second Amendment individual right to own and keep firearms in the home. And this is a massive, massive expansion of that. What the folks in this case, the petitioners, are seeking is to review a New York scheme that is over 100 years old, 108 years old, that essentially says in order to carry a firearm in New York, an applicant has to get a permit and has to show, quote unquote, proper cause, that they need that gun. And this is now subject to question. The argument is this fundamentally violates the right now laid out in the Heller case. And I think the real issue is if this New York regulation falls, the court may be not just upending regulations around the country in other states, but really, really signaling that gun regulations around the country are subject to being overturned. And so it's another big, big swing. And very much like the abortion case, interestingly, a big, big swing that is in real conflict with public opinion polling. American public opinion actually supports a lot of these gun regulations, but the court certainly looks as though it might be willing now to do away with an awful lot of state regulations around guns.
There's also death penalty cases coming up before the court. One reviewing an appeals court decision to throw out the death penalty of a man convicted of carrying out the Boston Marathon bombings. This Supreme Court allowed federal executions to go forward during 2020, also emergency docket decisions. What does that say about this court, Nelia, at this moment?
I think that's exactly right. This is of a piece with this larger trend, as you say, of this Supreme Court, this 6-3 supermajority to approve death sentences and also, as you say, to do it on the shadow docket.
Let me ask you about the popularity of this Supreme Court, which now includes three justices appointed by former President Donald Trump. It is not popular with the public. A Gallup poll from last month showed just 40% of Americans approve of the job the court is doing. What does that say to you, Dahlia, and why does this low approval rating matter?
I think that the answer to that question goes back to everything we started with, which is both that the Supreme Court has been doing a lot of things that feel like they are very, very consequential and important, and they're doing it on the shadow docket, and I think that alarms people. And I also think it's that the court is taking on these huge issues that are always so polarizing. And it's really worth noting that four of the justices, half the court, have given speeches just in the last 2 weeks saying the court isn't partisan, it's not political, stop saying that, in some cases blaming you and I and the press.
And as the Supreme Court begins its new term today, Dahlia, how do you see Chief Justice John Roberts role on the court with this new, larger conservative majority?
What a difference a year makes. I think 1 year ago, we were all saying it's the Roberts Court, that he was the median justice on a 4-4 court. In that intervening time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, Amy Coney Barrett came on. John Roberts is no longer the median. The median justice is now Brett Kavanaugh. And John Roberts has the unfortunate responsibility of either throwing in with the liberal justices, as he did, for instance, when they wanted to enjoin that Texas 6 weeks ban, or he can be part of a 6-3 supermajority. But either way, in a really, really fundamental way, the lesson is it's no longer his court. He's not the decider anymore.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.